there is always that conflict between you could do that quicker yourself, or it takes more time to kind of teach somebody kind of how to do it. You're teaching them how to fish, but they might not necessarily know how to pick that up, you know, maybe for a couple of months. And the restriction might be is that you only have a couple of weeks to work. I found, especially as the challenge is the time it takes to kind of upskill somebody versus the time pressures of the project are always at odds with each other.
Hi, I am Sophie Vaux, and this is the Rise and Play podcast. In the show, I sit down with influential thought leaders in the gaming industry to deconstruct how they create the best teams and company cultures in order to create the best games. Speaking to hundreds of game executives in the show, I have identified recurring patterns and mistakes that we all make in our leadership journey. Do you have to go through the same hurdles and make the same mistakes to learn too? You are not alone in this journey, and hopefully you can learn from a diverse range of seasoned leaders who already walk the talk. Every episode brings actionable insights and case studies that will help you improve your management skills, self-awareness, and empathic communication. Becoming a better leader starts with becoming a better human. Are you ready to unlock your full potential in life and business? Let's begin. Hi, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Rise and Play podcast. And today I'm welcoming Jamie Smith. And before we begin, a bit of an intro as well about Jamie. So Jamie is a principal game designer at People Can Fly and working on an accounting project and a BAFTA member where he has served on multiple award ceremony juries. So Jamie has over 13 years of experience in AAA games across numerous franchises, including Tom Clancy's, The Division from Ubisoft, FIFA from Electronic Arts, and Call of Duty from Activision. And additionally, that's why Jamie is here today, is an avid learner, keen to share his experience and challenge assumptions to provide value to his team and the project, and even, I would say, to the craft of design and what it means to be a leader in design, because as we connected, the conversation started from how do you grow into a position of leadership in design where most of your life and career you produce and suddenly you produce less. But what does that mean to be a principal game designer? But we get into that. So welcome, Jamie.
Yeah, nice to see you. It's very good. Thanks for being here.
So I would like to walk through a bit your career as a designer, because before you became principal game designer, I believe you had multiple roles in designs through those AAA companies and working on super popular iconic franchises. What have been your different roles, level of responsibility? Do you have a team? Yeah, what has been your evolution career?
Starting at the beginning, kind of 13 years ago, I'd originally started at Ubisoft on the Driver kind of franchise. And most of the projects I've kind of worked on since have been in the AAA space. And it's just been a natural kind of evolution from joining a team, being a member as part of that team, working on a feature, not necessarily having much autonomy over that feature kind of at the start, but you're helping to be one of the small parts, bringing, you know, a small piece to something kind of greater. That progressed onto the crew, where I was then responsible in a big open world driving game for effectively multiple features. It's a big open world game set in the US that was sparse of content. And the idea was that myself and a small mixed discipline team were together to basically populate that kind of world. And as time has went on with the Division, that was more of the same, and also the loot system within that, which is the core progression. The common kind of through line of these is with each project as it's went on, again in AAA, has been small teams, mixed discipline, that have slowly but surely increased in terms of autonomy as I've kind of grown through each of those roles. And then by the time I got to FIFA, experience in kind of post-launch aspects of the game, very kind of data-driven, which is a different approach to prior games. So that's moving on to Call of Duty and HUD Outlaws and Legends, which, you know, one is an iterative yearly franchise in Call of Duty. The other one was a AA, smaller scale kind of budget game, but with a team that basically had to go above and beyond what their normal roles might necessarily be. So by the time I was on that project, I wasn't just the owner of one feature. I was the owner of multiple features. And once again, with a mixed discipline team, so that could be programmers, animators, artists, UI designers, all collaborating to basically provide value in as short a time frame as possible in that case.
Were you solely focused on design? Because you said you were responsible for a team that has different discipline. I'm thinking more of structure of decision making, like in that kind of big team, are you responsible fully of the feature? And it could be anyone, that doesn't have to be just a designer, it could be also a lead programmer. How did the structure work of those first roles in leading a team? Because leading is about influencing towards an outcome.
Exactly, yes. So normally where the goal or the outcome would come from would be from the design direction. So we know where the target is, or we know where we're heading, but the team is completely autonomous in trying to achieve that goal. And typically, all of the teams that I've been part of, I've either been the one that's the spearhead of that team in terms of how we're going to go about things, who do we need to bring on board to make this thing come to life, or sometimes I might be the, you know, the judge of kind of quality before it progresses out of that team. So typically the way I've liked to work is I like the team to define what quality is and the team to sign off on that quality before we provide it to kind of anybody else. But on Hood Outlaws and Legends, for example, I was working with an extremely experienced programmer. And for the most part, that was between the two of us, was sharing that responsibility, where if one of us was kind of off work, for example, annual leave or illness, we would kind of share that. But generally speaking, the goals would be defined from design direction. And then it would be my role to kind of, you know, force the team down a given path that we thought was going to provide the most value, but ideally providing options that the team could, you know, influence where that path was going to go. Again, time permitting, when I say the word force, it is sometimes it has to be dependent on what the needs of the project are as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what was the structure and who has the last say in signing off a feature and how it will go in the game in the end. What are the challenges of leading this way, and what are the experiences you've had? Because I have seen often, coming from free-to-play, of course, I haven't worked on AAA production and premium, so I'm just wondering here, what are the differences? In free-to-play, the conflict is often in design versus product management. And then when we look at priorities and so on, it's like some are for the game and some are for the business of the game. So are there those kind of challenges where you have conflicting priorities from different craft and that may not, I would say, serve the direction you initially wanted in design?
Yeah, I mean that can come from effectively two sources internally within the team. So it could be the needs of a programmer, it could be the needs of an animator, that they might want to do something in a given way that doesn't necessarily, you know, follow the intended kind of goal. We had some issues kind of on Hood Outlaws and Legends, for example, about how high fidelity the animation could be versus input response. And that's always the classic kind of question that comes up. If you're making a game like Mario, it's all about the character and, you know, instant response. If you're doing something much more visceral and kind of grounded, then, you know, you might have to alleviate some of that response to get something that's higher fidelity in terms of animation. But that's internally. And then externally, you could get influence from the publisher as well, mm-hmm. in the sense that they could be looking at similar games on the market and saying, here are the areas where this game is not necessarily comparable in whatever way. It could be visual fidelity, it could be the way the gameplay mechanics could work. And ultimately, it's balancing the combination of all of those things with the core principle that comes from ideally, you know, creative or design direction. We're trying to create this particular experience, but we're also trying to balance or juggle all of these balls of, you know, other people's kind of not just opinions, but also could be informed by data, for example, telemetry and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And that is quite similar to how we work in free-to-play games, because you have so many stakeholders. You have how to market your game, and that can influence as well the design, the look, the theme of the game, all of that. The metrics, indeed, like how people are interacting with your game. Technical depth is another thing. So value in approaching the design of a game more holistically and not just, okay, let's go with a creative direction and let's say like narrow in our path and then the others have to adapt. And having more of this holistic product management structure mindset approach to games. So when did that start for you? Did that start before you joined People Can Fly, or it was like through your career, and at which step that happened exactly, this way of working and implementing design?
Because I've been in games for 13 years now, that it's just been a slow kind of building process, in the sense of most of those projects have been developed in a waterfall kind of way. They are typically long projects, long feature developments. And when I say long, it could be a couple of months at a time. It could be 3, 4, 5 months before you deliver any value to the game. And by that point, you have no time for iteration, because there might be a roadmap, and that roadmap has defined what you're doing for the next 4 years. And when you start to work that way enough, you realize that there's not enough time for iteration. It's taken too long to get the hands on the pad for the player, you know, a new feature. I've been on projects where we've maybe made a design document, but you don't necessarily feel the thing in your hands until, you know, a long time kind of later. And then what you also find is that features don't necessarily integrate very well. You could have multiple feature teams working on individual features, and they are only responsible for their own kind of siloed area. But when you bring those things together, it's like a jigsaw piece that doesn't kind of fit the puzzle. And then you find that out too late. And I think, as I said, that's been slowly but surely over time kind of come to fruition. But at the same time, people who are fresh to the industry, they probably wouldn't know any different. So, you know, they're kind of happy to roll with it. So on my side, it's just been a questioning that there might be a better way of doing things, or even if there's not a better way, that there could be a different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. And how has been your experience or initiative efforts in trying to have more of an iterative approach to game development or design for AAA games especially?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I quite like not just a holistic approach in the sense of thinking of the next person that's along kind of downstream. When features are going in the game, thinking about who's the next person that's about to pick up that particular aspect. So if you're working on a design, then you're thinking about the programmer. The programmer's got to think about the implementation's got to be done in such a way that they're exposing things that are comfortable for people to use, that they're laid out in interesting kind of ways. Also thinking about the long-term implications of things like telemetry. I've been on a lot of projects that don't think several steps ahead, and often it's a last-minute kind of panic to jump on and kind of alleviate that stuff. So in terms of my approach, when I say holistic, it's about trying to bring some of that stuff to the forefront. You know, have we thought about what happens to the next person that gets this, or have we thought about when it's post-launch? If we have a particular problem with a weapon in the game, for example, and, you know, the damage is too high, what is our process for kind of updating or reacting to feedback? And, you know, ultimately, a lot of projects think in kind of months and years. Mm. And I quite like the team to think of it in weeks and days in terms of delivering value, but consider the long-term implications of the way that we're implementing things when they get revisited. And as I said, there's not really been so much challenges with that. The real challenge has been the team trying to buy into that first, then delivering some value, and then basically it becomes like a contagious kind of thing within the broader team. They can see, typically for me, I'm more interested in 3 C's, so hands on the pad, character controls, and camera kind of features. When other teams see that we're working in a different way and doing so successfully, then it starts to be contagious. You know, maybe it will work with this team, maybe it will work with that team. But typically, it's difficult to kind of influence the team as a whole. So I typically like to start small.
Let's get into that, because this is a good leadership learning in practice, because there's the traditional approach, like waterfall as you described, and like making the plan, everything on paper for months and years. This is like a crazy idea for me in free to play, because this is gives me anxiety just making planning a game for 2 years, because you know it's going to be irrelevant from the moment you're already testing something, all your assumptions are falling. How do you influence in practice a team that has, I'm sure there are people who have worked in other companies in a certain way and believe in that way, to even start to work in a different way from the beginning? It helps to be in a position of influence to do that, but there's still, I can imagine, resistance from people to say, I'm a bit skeptical about this approach. So how did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, the first one is to kind of identify who might be the people who are open to kind of change. Mm. I think that's always the first barrier, because even as you mentioned, a skeptic or somebody who is massively experienced or somebody who has worked on that franchise, you know, let's say Call of Duty, they might have worked on 5 Call of Duties. this might be your first Call of Duty as it was for me, you also have to respect and appreciate that person probably has some knowledge that you don't necessarily have. So it's about finding the people that are kind of open first. And when I say open, the way I like to approach it is with agree on the big things and then disagree on the small things. And then that's the way how I like to build trust with individual people, which is if they've got an idea, let's say for a weapon and how it should behave, I'm not necessarily going to disagree with that or kind of challenge that assumption, but I might look at something much more minute, maybe the number of frames with an animation or what the texture of the materials, you know, we're using is. And then over time, that builds up credit in that person's mind that they're getting small bits of value from me that can ultimately lead to larger kind of influence. And once you've got that kind of trust built from 3, 4, 5 people on the team, that way you've kind of influenced people as a broader kind of scale. And as I said earlier, it kind of just goes from there. If you start to see one team that's been much more successful, that's how it can kind of influence others. But at the same time, it also should be done in a small scale scenario as well. I very rarely disagree with things on a large scale in a team or a conference call of 50 people, but you might do that in a small kind of one-to-one scenario or a small, you know, feature team kind of scenario as well.
Yeah. So to summarize, identify like the open people, I would say the champion of new ideas, the promoters, work with them like through the change, maybe in smaller settings, one-on-one instead of like, it never works anyway in big groups. And the factor of time is important here. It's not a change that goes overnight. Like what time frame are we talking about, you know, to really influence a change like this? How long was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on different projects, but AAA time isn't as much of a problem if it's a long-term kind of project. You know, as you said earlier, 2, 3, 4 years, these could be going on for. But ideally, within a couple of milestones, and typically some of the milestones I've kind of worked on, they might be every month, and then every 3 months we would have a release. So that would be the point where there's a meaningful kind of increment to the build. Ideally, within a couple of milestones, there has been some meaningful progress, not only in terms of what I personally have contributed towards the team, but also the team feeling influenced by, you know, not just my decisions, but feeling comfortable that I put my foot forward or I challenge some assumptions or I make some suggestions or there's some ideas for iteration, that they're feeling much more comfortable about approaching that stuff as opposed to challenging it. And over that kind of, you know, milestones, the first couple of weeks, they might challenge 50, 60, 70% of the things I mentioned. ideally, towards the end of those milestones, you would be looking at, you know, them challenging, you know, maybe 10 or 20% of those, because sometimes challenging an individual is good, but it shouldn't be relentless.
Mm-hmm. So as you are implementing the change, you say like you look at it in the milestone. Concretely, how do you measure success of what is a better for development? Because again, you don't see the end of the tunnel until you release the game, I mean, at least with the reviews of players.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of quality or producing something, there has to be something functional. So I think that would be the first step, which is if you're working as part of a team in AAA and you're not seeing the fruits of your labors for multiple months, success would be making that multiple weeks. And then success after that would be you can see things in a matter of days. And ideally, you know, in a really high velocity team and in a matter of hours. That doesn't necessarily produce quality, but it does mean that you're going to have more time for iteration or you're going to get through more iterations. And one thing I quite like to do is between the start of a milestone and the end of a milestone, I like to create a video. I use a lot of editing kind of software and I will record a playthrough of what we've done the previous milestone.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and then put that alongside what we did in the current milestone. And that basically shows people on a day-to-day basis, some people, especially in AAA, can be working on tasks and you can ask them what they're working on, but not necessarily why or how it's contributing towards the bigger picture. When you show them a month's worth of progress versus the previous month, you can see that there's a big jump in the multitude of kind of changes that they've made. So that's always a good way. And then the good feeling that comes from that rolls into the next milestone. And then, as we said earlier, another success would be the percentage of time that people are challenged, you know, in terms of their assumptions, or maybe we could try this, that wouldn't necessarily be challenged as much as it would be in the first instance. But yeah, creating more iterations is a good one.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. But it's also not so quantitative when the percentage of a resistance that you have from a team. It's an interesting metric. So it's more like the openness to change and iterating, which is a mindset, right? Agility, it's not so much about, okay, should it be premium or free to play? There's a lot also to learn in getting better in the way you work, and your engine of learning is much faster when you are iterative and sticking to a certain way of working and keeping it that way. So yes, you have influenced teams to make the change in more agile. Like one thing as well about the videos that you mentioned, which is, I think, something one of my former colleagues was also using that as a product manager. So it's a product manager technique to show the team the sense of progress. And this is very rewarding, motivating. Where did you get that idea from? Like, have you learned any agile development program, or this came intuitively, or it was done from other teams? How do you come up with those ideas?
A little bit of both. So I'm qualified as a Scrum product owner. I've been looking into that stuff for a while. I'm quite open to new things and trying new things and experimenting. And over time, especially when the pandemic came around, I watched a whole lot of documentaries about game development. And one of them that came up was from For Honor. I forget the name of the documentary.
Was it Jason, the name of a creative director? Yes. That's it.
Yeah. So we watched that. And where the idea originally came from was they were streaming playtests in their studio on big screens, and people could watch it as they were doing their work, or, you know, maybe it's on an afternoon to celebrate the progress, or maybe it's a playtest. And especially at the start of the pandemic, I had the idea within our team to basically stream games on a server so we could watch multiplayer playtests. And then the follow-on from that became I was snipping together some of those playtests to have a showcase of kind of gameplay, you know, cool kills, you know, interesting kind of things that players had found. And then that progressed on to using those videos to kind of showcase what we did from the previous month versus the month after. And because I had such a large bank of kind of this data, I could go back to build 6 months ago and say to people, hey, here's what the game looked like 6 months ago. Here's what the game looks like today. And then it's basically progressed from there. So normally I do it on a milestone basis now.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think this is a great practice and routine. From my memory, when we had the studio as well, and we were putting all of this together, it's such a powerful video because you realize the amount of work you've done in a snippet, like 5 minutes, 2 minutes. And it's very motivating as a team to see this concretely, because when you are in the development, okay, you move some tickets here and there, and but you don't really feel the progress. But this is very powerful to see it in a game and like visual and the gameplay and so on. So very good practice.
The best example that I'd seen of it for one project was a programmer doing a doodle, and literally it was a tiny little scribble drawing. And what we progressed and had after several months, people couldn't believe it. But when I put the video together, the first thing that I showed was the doodle, this tiny little image of what the programmer had kind of came up with. And it progressed from a 2D scribble kind of on a, you know, a napkin to effectively a playable product within, you know, a couple of months, you know, maybe 6 weeks.
By the way, I don't know if those videos are public. I think it's a great practice to show and share just for others to also maybe take that with for them and also do it as a routine. You know, each time you reach a milestone, it's like in agility, a retrospective. You look back what has happened and feel gratitude and pride for what you've achieved.
Yeah, exactly. I think for one project for Hood, Outlaws and Legends, I did record a video, and it was more of a GDC style presentation about how we did bow and arrow mechanics. That is published online, but obviously with some NDAs and, you know, restrictions in the industry, it's not always the case. But in this case, that's available online. I think it's bow design in Hood, Outlaws and Legends. And that shows the very first version that we had. It's in Unreal Engine using flat, basic shaded mannequin characters. They're almost like dummies from a clothes shop, right, to fully animated, fully textured kind of characters. The video itself is less than an hour long, but it represents about 2.5 years worth of work.
If you find it, share it for the show notes later, please.
Perfect.
Let's move more as well now the conversation into your role and your evolution in design and your career, because now you are also principal game designer, which principle is really more the path of expertise in your craft rather than what we call it management track. Like usually you have those two career paths. And so I wanted to understand when that shift happened for you, when maybe you were less and less hands-on in design, but more directing, influencing people. How long ago was that? When did that happen? What was the context?
Yeah, that was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, kind of at this point. And really, it was for me a natural evolution of kind of spearheading mixed discipline teams originally to then becoming the point of contact for designers in general. Because as teams are getting bigger, as projects are getting bigger, one individual or one feature team is not necessarily responsible for multiple areas. But especially in my case, because of the projects I'd been on previously, I'd had a lot of knowledge about, say, progression systems and weapon systems and how characters work and, you know, different approaches. And slowly but surely, it was more about disseminating that knowledge amongst the team. And I was fortunate enough on Hood Outlaws and Legends, we had a small enough team that I was responsible for a handful of designers, giving them feedback on different things, which could be, you know, level design, it could be, you know, AI patrol paths, stealth kind of mechanics, and so on. And as I say, when it's a natural evolution, that was just a body of knowledge that is kind of sat in somebody's head. And it slowly but surely became about kind of providing others with that wealth of knowledge. But at the same time, nobody is kind of an oracle of knowledge either. Mm-hmm. So it's just about, in some cases, providing some guidance. But the challenge that comes with that is that in some cases, when time is against you, there is always that conflict between you could do that quicker yourself, or it takes more time to kind of teach somebody kind of how to do it. You're teaching them how to fish, but they might not necessarily know how to pick that up, you know, maybe for a couple of months. And the restriction might be is that you only have a couple of weeks to work. So I think that is always, I've found, especially as the challenge is the time it takes to kind of upskill somebody versus the time pressures of the project are always at odds with each other.
That transition in influencing and less doing, how did that go for you? Because we discussed it before and I have seen this for many designers, they enter in the profession for doing, creating something, you know, like doing things with their hand, producing. It's the same with programmers, which I have heard as well, the same struggle when they're becoming more in management position, they are not touching too much code. How difficult or easy was it for you for that transition and maybe a reevaluation of your own identity as a professional? What happened?
I think you always have to at least try something. So the natural evolution for a lot of people will be, if you don't mention it in your performance reviews, or the natural evolution will be is that people will automatically get promoted into management positions. And that's not necessarily a bad thing until you get to a point where maybe that isn't necessarily for you, or maybe that's the first time that you've experienced that kind of side of it. For me, I've been responsible for multiple kind of mixed discipline teams, where the only difference was is that instead of chatting to mixed discipline folks, I was mostly responsible for people in my own kind of discipline. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the hands-off approach, to me, it's always a percentage. In all of the roles that I've been part of, principal and lead are almost identical to each other in terms of hands-on knowledge, experience, guidance for others. The only difference is that the leader is responsible for upskilling the team, and that's in terms of the quality they provide is upskilling others. They're a force multiplier for the team, whereas a principal is more hands-on. So it's more of you're judged based on the features that you develop. And to me, that's always been the other side of it, which is, what is the percentage that you're kind of allocating to either of those things? And I find that when it becomes a 50-50, that's great in kind of either side. But for different people, you may prefer the hands-on development side. Mm-hmm. And then when it becomes 70-30 in the favor of management, that's where some people might, you know, hanker for getting back into the engine and doing 3D modeling or whatever it may be. The same is true of the opposite, which is, the rate in which Unreal Engine is kind of updating their features right now, somebody might prefer to be a hands-on manager, let the team kind of learn all the new software and then learn the new knowledge, and then bring that back to everybody else. So you're taking more of a hands-off role because you're not necessarily up to date with every single release that's kind of coming out for an engine. You're not necessarily the body of knowledge that you once were.
Mm-hmm. And is there a part that you prefer in the two parts that you just described, like the management or the hands-on? Like, what did you say? Yeah, scaling up the team?
Upscaling the team. As of right now, I mean, I'm a principal. I've always loved the hands-on kind of development. I still get to kind of mentor people on the team. I mean, that doesn't stop me from passing my experience to others, or you're the go-to person because you have experience in a given area. But the one thing I found, especially when you become a lead, is just that the feeling that you get from upskilling others, and then you see them take on board your advice, and then you see the value that provides for the game. It's an indescribable kind of feeling that I've had, and I had a brief stint in academia, which is pretty cool as well. In terms of fulfillment, I've had more fulfillment from mentoring and guiding kind of others than I have for any feature that I've ever developed. But at the same time, I don't ever want to lose sight of the reason I got into games in the first place is because I like to, you know, tinker and experiment with things. But as of right now, I'm a principal, pretty happy with that, still mentoring kind of people within the team. I'm less precious about the title personally and more precious about the things that I'm doing day to day. And again, helping out feature teams and helping out other designers is what I do on a daily basis anyway.
And what would you say are the skills required to be principal in a design career?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different things that you always need to be somebody who's got an open mind. I think with an industry that's basically open to new technologies, new genres, new ways of doing things, I think having an open mind not only makes you a good team player, but also makes you the person who is, especially if you're the lead of a team, the person who can rub off that influence on the next person. If you're more of a closed book, you might not necessarily be the person that they would want to go to for that. I think another one is just that you always need to remember the reason why you got into games kind of in the first place. When you're getting up to, you know, really long projects, as we mentioned before, it's very easy to kind of become jaded or a little frustrated because your features aren't getting into the game that quickly. But you might have got into the games because you love the feeling of Mario, you love the satisfaction of, you know, the way some weapons or whatever else it may feel in the game. Ultimately, those are the two things that you should never lose. And the other one is just a thirst for knowledge, because the industry moves so fast that, especially with design documents, you know, we mentioned it earlier, when you close a design document, in some ways, it's already out of date. And that's very much a description of how I would say about the industry is you could learn something about a given feature, about how to kind of mentor others. And then the next couple of days, that could be not only out of date, but there is, you know, an addition to that or something that you have to keep abreast of. But yeah, you know, embracing your values, a natural kind of curiosity. And then the other one, just about playing to your strengths. We were chatting about this earlier, about making recordings, showing the team kind of progress. Those are the types of things that I do personally that kind of help, you know, others directly or indirectly. And I do that because I quite like video editing, and that's something that I'm kind of interested in. Mm-hmm. Somebody else might do the same thing, but they might be doing, you know, a different kind of approach with the presentation or wherever else it may be. So it's just leveraging your skills to kind of help others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, all those qualities are the ones that you have need in growing others and motivation of leadership. So I have last questions then. So without, of course, revealing too much, because I know you're working on also on an unannounced project that people can fly. What is your mission with your role today? How big is your team? What's the difference with your previous? I believe it's smaller, right? And what makes you excited about this role and the future with working with that company?
I can't say too much, obviously, you know, license and NDA kind of permitting, but yeah, we're working on a pretty tight-knit kind of mixed discipline team. There is lots of opportunity, especially at People Can Fly, for people to bring their knowledge, and they are open to people effectively improving projects. They're very autonomous. I mean, we have lots of projects kind of going at the moment. There is a shared knowledge. There is a shared kind of company. But the projects are allowed to kind of run themselves, which is not necessarily what I've experienced in the past, especially if it's an extremely successful franchise where you might get more of a top-down kind of management approach of, we've done this several times before, here's how you should do things. I would say People Can Fly are kind of the opposite, which is the teams will find their own success. They are self-managing kind of teams. Mm-hmm. They are completely autonomous, determining their own kind of value. But in terms of what those projects kind of involved, I probably can't say too much more. But I would say that you know, PCF has worked on shooter games, action kind of genre, and I think Bulletstorm VR is out kind of soon. But between those, there's not much else I could say about the project specifically.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, it sounds interesting as well, this model of small teams and autonomous, which allows actually quite a lot of efficiency and of a back to a way of working that you describe, which is iterative. And basically it's team owning and learning constantly to get better. So I could assume at least you have more time to do hands-on work and a bit less to have to manage, because if, you know, the team is managing themselves, it's then more time to actually produce them.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not small in the sense of, you know, maybe 10 or 15 people. So some teams could be that small, especially depends on the stage of development. But even, you know, maybe larger teams that are within the project, they feel like they're much more autonomous and have more creative kind of ownership than maybe some other teams have experienced previously. But at the same time, there is an openness to kind of change, or an openness to kind of progress in things. It's not waterfall versus agile, it's we are going to find our own path that works the best for us and what delivers the most value. And that might differ based on, you know, maybe the publisher, the needs of the project, but it's that openness to a conversation, that openness to basically trying new things. Is it's not just the thing that excites me most, but it's a place where I feel like you're empowered to kind of do that.
And on those last words, I think you have described a value that is super important in that openness, because not being attached to any one way that is the best, but being adaptable, also identifying the needs, and again, not being stubborn and rigid. And it's true, we have quite some legacy in the industry about certain ways of doing things that are hard to change in a bigger organization, and also by history, because it's how we do success. So it's refreshing to hear also other smaller AAA studio maybe, but also working in a more modern way.
Exactly, yeah. And it always depends just in terms of success comes through the door. I know that on Call of Duty, for example, on a prior project, that was hugely successful, that makes it more difficult because they've had success in the past and they don't necessarily want to stray away from what made them successful in the first place.
Yeah, always the same story. All right, Benjamin, on those last wise words, thank you very much for joining the podcast today and sharing, giving a bit more light as well in AAA development and maybe the evolving ways of working with people like you who are championing just an open, more open way of working, more flexible, and also bringing more light into different path of profession in design, what it is to be a principal. And at the end of the day, whether you're principal or just management track, especially in design position, you are in a role of leadership because you need to influence a group. So even as a senior designer or as the main designer, you're always in a responsibility of leading. And that was nice to hear your experience and progression for your career today. So thanks for joining.
Oh, thanks very much again. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, and hopefully it's helpful.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Rise and Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders, because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on riseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time.